Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 28th, 2006. Our session today is entitled, Is Wealth Demoralizing? Our presenter is John Wallace, session number WAJO 2006-9. Let's listen in.
My name is John Wallace. How many of you have just seen it or... Have all of you been here before?
No.
Not to Holden Village.
To one of your talks.
To one of my things.
No.
How many have been to any church? Okay.
No.
All right, now it's no big deal. We just got to get everybody on the same page. And Dan and John are going to like this because they can do more hours to
do. We're wondering how it's going to come out.
Yeah. I'm just going to live.
I'm betting on Dan.
I'm betting on Dan. I'm
told you already.
Okay. Let's see.
But if you spend too much time orienting the newcomers, then we'll never get to the end of the story.
I know. That's the problem. But that really gets to be the problem by Friday. Which is that, how do we get the newcomers oriented? So I'll try to do that real quickly. I want to make sure I read my stuff because I get the word from Dan every morning. Romans 8, 12, and on. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors. Okay? That's it. That's all I need to read. This is actually pretty interesting. Dan didn't really sort it out for me, and I still get the syntax of this is hard to follow. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors, not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh, dash. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. And so I'm not sure who we're debtors to. The debtor kind of thing kind of slipped away in that sentence there. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption, which was what Dan was talking about this morning. And then this was 2 Colossians, which I read last week after Ron gave me the... I go to Bible study every morning now. This is 2 Colossians. Well, it's kind of like you'll see. 8 through 10, chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deceit. Now, I'm a doctor of philosophy, so take care. Self-abasement and worship of angels, dwelling on visions, puffed up without cause by a human way of thinking, and not holding fast to the head, for whom the whole body is nourished and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows with the growth that is from God. These have body things in them. We've been talking about a little bit about bodies and chairs and different things. And laws. We've been talking about law. The problem, if we look at the world, okay, this is if we plot out, this is time, and we plot out income, say, what happens in the United States is it goes up, okay? And even though it's rising at the same rate, it goes up steeper and steeper, so it gets hard to put on the graph. And so there's a trick. I don't know, we got a bunch of engineers here who know how to take logarithms. Yeah. So we say this is 1, and this is 10. And this is 100. Okay, so every unit represents 10 times bigger. And if we plot out this line, it turns out that it looks like this for the United States. It means that over time, income in the United States, since 1840, since we were first starting to measure it, has grown at 1.5% per person. And just forever. Which is really phenomenal, because if you think that, you know, there's the Great Depression, there's some blips in here. Nothing appears to matter.
Republicans, Democrats, Whigs, Civil Wars, World Wars, Great Depression, it doesn't matter, it has this growth of 1.5% per year, which gives you pause when you think about policies. But then it also turns out, if you go and you look at the rest of the world, that if you take the, you know, the 25 richest countries, or John's, you know, OECD data or UNESCO data, they're all like lying right along here. And even if you're somebody like Japan, who starts out low, you come to this line. Now, the problem, then, is that there's a group of countries, say we, that look about like this. And then there's a group of countries that look about like this. Okay? Now, remember that these are, every unit gets 10 times bigger. So even though these are proportionally remaining the same, the absolute differences are getting wider as they get richer. So what's happening is that since the middle of the 19th century, per capita income in Latin America has been about a third of what it is in the United States, and it's still about a third of what it's been in the United States. And so now, that a third of $44,000 a year is a lot of difference. Right? So the difference between Latin American incomes and American incomes were smaller in 1850 than they are now. But in relative terms, the gap has stayed the same. So what's happening, unfortunately, I know these lines are a little hard to read, and it doesn't really matter, you get the idea. These are not converging. Okay. Now, these are going up, they're getting richer. One of my favorite stories of the last year, maybe it'll become one of the favorite stories of my life, is that there's a tribe in the Amazon. The tribe in the Amazon is so primitive, quote unquote primitive. I don't know where we're going to go with primitive and culture and all that sort of stuff. They only have words for the number 0, 1, and 2. And more than 2. Okay? So the linguists want to go down there and they want to see, how well do these people add? Is there a language function to mathematics? And so they designed this experiment and they went out into the Amazonian jungle to talk to these people and to give them these tests that they designed. And they said, we want to have objects with which these people are perfectly familiar so that, you know, they won't get freaked out by what we're doing. So guess what the three objects they had to add and subtract were? Rocks. Sticks. What's the third?
Children.
Batteries. Okay, so these people are so far out of it that they haven't got the number 3 yet. They live in the Amazonian rainforest, and batteries are an important enough part of their daily life that they're like sticks and stones. Globalization. Okay, why is this line going up? Well, in fact, what's happened, this was partly the Green Revolution stuff that John was talking a little bit about yesterday and this morning, that the technology of the world has changed, and everybody is benefiting from that in some measure. So incomes really are rising everywhere in the world, although they're still really, really low in really, really poor countries. Okay, but they're better off than they were a century ago. But they're not catching up. I mean, there's some simple fundamental theorems in economics which say, oh, these should all converge because poor people should get out of there and move to rich countries. Right? Well, okay. That assumes, in some sense, that the social systems in these two countries is the same and that these are simply less productive people and they should move here to be more productive. It doesn't work that way. So the point of this week, and sort of my life to this point, I'm 54, I'm not dead yet, is why? Why are these guys so here? I would say, why are they so screwed up? You know, I got this cultural oops thing. Why is that? How do we understand that? Where do we go? So we've been working on a notion that we call, that I call the natural state or limited access society. Dan and John are our two warlords. We have an extremely violent society. And we know from the archaeological record that hunting and gathering societies are extremely violent, and that there's no myth of a peaceful. It is a myth of a peaceful savage. That didn't exist, or rarely existed. So how are we going to get? If we're all fighting each other, and we have these small competing social groups, how are we going to solve that problem? And the solution that we came up with, I came up with, is what we call the natural state. We give John and Dan property rights to everything. They're the two strongest people. They own everybody. right? Because there's a lot of violence, and of course, John and Dan are the two most violent people. They're the two most dangerous people. And by doing that, by giving them property rights in everybody, they, because they're strong, can enforce each other's rights. And what happens is they stop fighting. And the reason they stop fighting is because the rest of us are more productive if they don't fight. And since they get to keep everything that we produce, you know, beyond subsistence, if we produce more, they're better off. So they stop fighting, so they will produce more and they get richer. We don't get richer. Well, we get a little bit richer because we're not dying as much. So we call that a natural state. And that turns out to be a way in which most human societies are organized. In fact, in the world today, I assert that about 175 countries are still natural states. There's a bunch of small elite, not just the military, economic elites, religious elites, cultural elites, are the ones who receive the rents from limited access. They have privileged positions in their society, and they get returns from those privileges. Economists would call them rent residue, the extra profits, if you will, extra goodies. Okay? And because of that, they have a strong incentive to support the society that they live in. Okay? So it's a limited access social order. Now, Dan was talking about water this morning. He has a theological thing about privatizing water. You know how much water costs in Latin America? In many places, it's free. Does that mean you can get it? No, if you live in Mexico, and you want to get your water hooked up, you better be connected to the local political organization. So why would a politician want to charge a lower price for water if he had control over the allocation of water? Why wouldn't he want to charge the highest price? Well, yeah, more people would support him, right? In other words, remember, as we've been talking about all week, in the natural state, you use economics and politics to manipulate each other. In fact, you manipulate the economy to generate political support. So in India has this terrible electrical system. They generate lots of power. Of the power they generate, 50% never gets to consumers who pay for it. Of the power that does get to people, they give it away to farmers. Getting hooked up to an electrical wire in India can take you 6 months. Of course, unless you know the right guy. Right? Because, in fact, electricity is used for political purposes in India, as well as economic purposes. So that privatization can be a complicated thing depending on what the alternative is. The idea that water should be free and available to everyone is great. I agree. I think that's a right thing. But in Arizona, that's a problem. Because there's not enough water. Right? So how do we do that? I don't want to talk too much more about the problem, but there are, in fact, the natural state typically screws markets up because it doesn't use prices to allocate resources, it uses politics to allocate resources. Okay? Religion in natural states is often screwed up because the religious authorities are part of the existing political structure. And that existing political structure appears to us to be repressive and appears to them to be great because it provides order. Okay? And people in a natural state are not about to become the United States of America. They're about to become Rwanda or Cambodia. If you live in the Middle East today, you're not worried about incipient economic growth. You're worried about Armageddon. And you would like to figure, I don't care who it is, just figure this stuff out. Get these guys to stop fighting each other. Let's get John and Dan on the same page. You want my wealth? Take my wealth. You want my house? Take my house. Just stop fighting. Okay? We don't see that as a problem in the United States because we don't live with that kind of violence. It's hard for us to see that. Now, so that's the summary. Balance is one of the things that's in here. Yep?
No,
I'm waving at that fly.
I'm waving that fly away.
Swat that fly. Hi, I'm from Holden Village. Tina Walder. One of the problems with modern social science is that there's politics, there's political science, there's economics, there's sociology, there's anthropology, there's psychology, And these things are all divided, and they're academic specialties, and there's reasons for why they're divided. But it's extremely difficult. William, there's one right here. It's hard to integrate them. But the story we've been telling about the John Dan Society is, in fact, one in which the political and economic and religious systems are closely integrated. In fact, that's how they work. So we can't understand them as economic or political systems independent, right? Although that's how we tend to look at them. So when we read the history of politics, we read the history or the anthropology of politics, we see these pieces without necessarily drawing all the connections. Now, in the world that we live in, and the worlds that the societies that are up here, order is not provided by rent creation or by limited access. Order is provided by competition. We talked yesterday about what happened after the Reformation when we begin to get fragmented religions, which is initially enormously violent, not enormously peaceful. Okay? That you need competition. In America and in most European countries, we have religious freedom. Some European states still have a state church. Massachusetts had a state church. In Massachusetts, in their first constitution in 1780, everybody had to pay a tithe. And if you didn't belong to a recognized church, you still had to pay your tithe to the state, and the state would distribute it to the churches. You know, talk about separation of church and state. They weren't quite there in Massachusetts yet. Okay. So what happens is we begin to get competition in the world, and now we can provide order by competitive political parties, by competitive economics, by competitive religion, by competitive education, because if one group starts to get the upper hand, we vote the scoundrels out. Now we vote for John and Dan and lots of other people. There's competition. Now, in order for that to prevail in the world, we need to have some changing kinds of social structures. And I did this last week, so I can't really say, if I was here for another week, I would talk about this, because I wouldn't like to talk about what I talked about this week again. Where we'd have John Wallace II, you know, the return of John Wallace, or something like that. And we were talking about, how do you get from being on this line or this line to this line? How is it that you make this transition? You know, we'd have to go back and look at what actually makes people more productive. We've argued that people are more productive if they work together in organizations, and that that's incredibly necessary for societies to function. Okay? And that organizations are of two types. Adherent organizations, which are purely voluntary, where people belong to them of their own free will and can leave at any point. So those organizations essentially have to depend on unanimity to function. They don't do very well. They can't do very much. And then there's contractual organizations, where the agreements between people are enforced by a third party. What's Holden Village? A contractual organization. I mean, we want to be here. We are voluntarily here, but we are not voluntarily organized. Okay? We have people with contracts. The Holden Village is a corporation. It's an entity whose rules, internally and externally, are enforced by the state of Washington, the government of the United States, and the county of Chelan. So what we were talking about yesterday, and now I'm almost done with the review, and we're just about to have to leave. Sorry. It's a Holden Village kind of thing. Is that what we begin to see in Europe after the Reformation, I don't want to say because of the Reformation, because it's not clear Reformation cause effect in this kind of development. I've been talking about Europe since like the 11th century. That the first business incorporations occur in Britain, the Russia Company, in 1561, in which you create a business firm, which is a joint stock company, which issues stock. It's clearly a limited access, natural state, Dan John kind of organization, because it's all wealthy people that are connected with the government of Britain, or England at that point, who own stock in the corporation. They have a monopoly. They're given a sole monopoly on trade with Russia. But once they begin to get stock that they can sell, it becomes at some point in their interest to open access a little bit, because William's not a member of the elite. Well, I'm sorry, William. You could be. You're a prince of price, as we learned this morning, right? We're all members of the elite, but let's assume for the moment William's not. And I want to sell him some stock. Well, if he's not a member of the elite, he doesn't get access to the law. So he won't pay me as much for my stock because he knows that he can't take me to court to get dividends. So I, the guy who owns the stock, have every incentive to make sure that he gets legal rights. Because if he has legal rights, I can sell my stock to him for more money. Right? Now when I do that and I start guaranteeing his rights, now we're beginning to move out of the John Dan world into a world in which there's access and competition. Now it happens gradually. It takes place in four places first that we know of. The United States, Britain, France, and the Low Countries, Netherlands. Switzerland calls along fairly shortly thereafter. Does anybody know which are the first four countries to have incorporated businesses? Britain, France, the United States, and Low Countries. When does the United States get started? 1607, it started as a corporation, the Virginia Company. Right? It's got a charter, it's an organization, it has a constitution that's written down. Now, what happens then is that we get more and more powerful forms of organization, and that's exactly how Dan and John hold their coalition together. If people are more productive, if they're embedded in organizations, and Dan and John are the natural third parties because they're the kick-ass guys in the society, and they only promise to enforce agreements for this group of people over here and not everybody else, these guys will all become rich. And who will they support? Each other and Dan and John. Right? So that one of the key elements is limited access to organizations. Now, what are corporate? If we were to have one word to describe what corporations are in America, including at Holden Village, our view of them, corporations are a four-letter word with a V in the middle and an L at the end. They are evil. Right? They're corporations. They're big, nameless, faceless corporations who happen to be made up of people. Right? So we have a way of thinking about these organizations as evil, and partly what I want to talk a little bit about today is why we have that feeling, that thinking of where it comes from, and how, in some sense, we misunderstand what's happening in the process of the transition to an open access society if we continue to believe that organizations are inherently evil. Okay. Now, but this is a very different lecture than last Friday's, because last Friday I had some guilt and some personal things that I had to get off my chest. I had to make some confessions about, you know, who I am, what I do. One of my confessions that I'm going to make this week is that here's my World Bank ID card. I am a consultant at the World Bank. I have a little World Bank thing, because when I go to the World Bank, I have to clip it on me. Or maybe I should wear this for the rest of the year. It's interesting, you know, some people believe the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, the IMF are inherently evil.
Evil.
Right? It's very interesting. When you go to the World Bank and you walk around the buildings, there's lots of buildings. They own I've been in like six buildings in downtown D.C. They look like Holden Village bulletin boards. Believe me, the people who work at the World Bank want to help poor people. That's what it says right on the wall. You know, to end poverty. Okay. They're a big corporation. But they got, you know, let's Nicaraguan homeless women. Let's have a session on this and a session on that. It's all over the place. Okay? I get kind of goofy when I'm like, wait, I work for the World Bank. Why must we be evil? I don't know. Okay, so that's one of my confessions, is that in fact part of what I'm doing, I'm really concerned, because I figure if I can get China from here to here, I'm going to do more good than delivering a trillion meals to people. Part of my guilt is I don't deliver meals to people. I go to the World Bank. Of course, it helps pay for my son's tuition, you know, because if they pay attention to me, they give me money. But John knows all about that, right? No. Well, you're going to get these films made, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we all are kind of advocates for certain kinds of things. So that part of what I wanted to say yesterday in my proclamation I wasn't quite so good about, this, you know, but Paul Hinderly has been reminding me of this all week, what Martin Luther said, you know, a good deed, you know how a good deed is defined? A good work?
Bears fruits.
Yes, it does my neighbor good. Not me. Right? We have a problem, I think. with wanting to do things that redeem us. Not the people we're trying to help. Would it be better to have a bad theological water scheme that gets cleaner water to people, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, I think it's a hard thing to kind of think about how we do. And I want to get to Brian. You know, we've got to get to this how do we do it part. In open access societies, everybody has access to organizational forms. You can form a political party, you can form a church, you can form a business, and society will support you. Now, I said 10 minutes, you know, it's Wealth Demoralizing. I had Machiavelli, Harrington, Polybius, I don't know, Foucault. I got hammered last week because I didn't talk about Foucault in 10 minutes or less. So here we go. We'll see if I can do it. In a natural state, in a limited access order, everybody... Oh, don't start my 10 minutes yet. Okay, here's the problem. How do people learn? Cognition. There's a huge, you know, growing field of cognitive science and neuroscience about how people learn. Okay, so I'm a person, and when babies are born, you know, they're learning machines in all kinds of different ways, right? And I don't need parents to learn about that, gravity. You know, if I don't learn about it, I'm going to be dead and broken and all that. So I'm going to learn about that really fast, right? So that we're tuned into learning from experience. So we learn things. But how else do we learn?
Observation.
Yeah, no, but that's experience, right? We see things, we feel things, we touch things. How many of you have, do you want to talk to me about money?
Yeah.
How many of you know how money works? Yeah, it's clueless, right? It's a mystery. You know, this stuff isn't what you make good toilet paper.
Yeah.
But yet, nonetheless, like, okay. Now, I know how it works. And I said I could do it in 20 minutes. I'm not going to do it today. Why? But I could in 20 minutes give you a much greater insight into how money works. And what would I be doing? Teaching you. Right? How many of you learned from teaching? If you didn't, immediately our parents start telling us stuff. Don't put your finger in the socket. Do not put the fork in the socket. Jimmy does, Jimmy dies. Jimmy might get lucky, right? Don't run in the street. Don't vote Republican. How do you learn about these things? Okay, now here's the problem. My favorite definition of culture is all the things that are taught from one generation to the next, or because we have overlapping generations taught continuously. If we learn that men open the door for women, doesn't have much anymore, and everybody around us does that, we think that's a law. Not a legal law. We think that's a law of human behavior because we all do it. And because we all do it, we can't see that it's possible not to do it. And we are hardwired to think that's a fact about the world I've got to pay attention to. Mwebe has been talking about culture this week and how hard it is to change it and how different they are. Because, in fact, there's lots of different ways to structure human societies. And we learn the rules automatically. And we don't think of them as things that could be different. We think of them as the way things are. Turn the clock back on. If I live in a John Dan world, I learn and I know that this is how the world is set up. If I'm an elite, I know I'm privileged. And if I'm not, I know I'm not. Right? That is the order of things. Now, we may think it's unjust and unfair, and in fact, we tend to think it's unjust and unfair a lot more than the people living in those societies, right? Because we see our world, which does not have that mechanism at all. We see freedom as coming from God. It's our natural right to have it. And when we go to societies where they don't have it, we say, something must be wrong with this society. Who's to blame? Right? Now, I'm not so sure that's right. I agree with Mwebe. I'm not so sure that we can see what's going on there. It took me 54 years to begin to see some of the ways in which my society was structured and ordered and why those were different than the way other societies were structured and ordered. And it's very hard for this for us to see this because it's like, is a fish aware of water? No. What's in this room? Nothing. Oh, wait, air! Huh? There's stuff in here? Well, we know it intellectually, right?
But John, don't we have a greater responsibility of living in a country where we have the luxury to think about?
I think we do. I think we do. And I think we got to think about what is actually going on. How many of you think that people in poor countries are poor because we're rich?
There's only so much money in the world, right?
No, there's all the money in the world you want. You can print it up. They have huge printing presses.
It stands for energy and work.
Yeah, I know. You know, that's the problem there, though. Because, in fact, there's more stuff in the world. John's talking about that every day, right? People that choose to have more stuff. We have problems. Now we have 5 Earths worth of stuff if everybody has as much stuff as we do, so we can't have that much stuff, but there really is more stuff. Because there couldn't have been that much stuff before because we only had 5 Earths. Right? In other words, it is the case that there's more stuff in the world today than there was before. Okay? We've generated more things. We've generated more value. Do not fool yourself that these people are better off. More stuff he wanted me to be. It fries my ass, is what she liked, what I said on Friday. It fries my ass when people at Holden Village or anywhere else say, if we bring economic growth to the third world, we are going to debase the morals of those people because as they get more consumption, they will become less valuable, they will become less moral, they will become less ethical. I think, God, that is the ultimate in pride. I'm so rich that I can afford to tell you that you would be worse off if you were as rich as me. How can we possibly say that? How can we possibly believe that what happens in the rest of the world is all dependent on us?
It's part of our cultural story.
Yeah. Right.
What? It seems like so often you hear of people going to a place where the people are really, really poor.
Yeah.
But they're so happy.
Yeah.
Nothing. And then all of us who have so much and we're depressed all the time.
You know, I know lots of... Do you know happy rich people? I know lots of happy rich people.
Yeah.
Do you know unhappy poor people? I know lots of unhappy poor people. What gives? Well, you know what? It's really a gift to be happy. You know, some people, you all know people who are happy, right? You all know people who are unhappy?
But it sounds like in poor countries there's more.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Boy, those people are happy. Right? Is wealth demoralizing? Does wealth make us more or less happy? I don't think so. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay? I'm not, you know, it's hard to study this kind of thing, but in fact, I'm not sure whether more or less happy or sad, right? More time. I think some of the things that John is talking about this week are really, really important about how much time we have and what we do and how we feel about ourselves, right? And we know, okay, I told you earlier in the week economics is choice. And last Friday I said, you know, what happens with your kids? You want to give them as many choices as you can, right? That's giving them wealth. Even if you don't have money, you can give them choices. And what do they do with those choices? Do they pick what you want? No, inevitably they pick something else, which doesn't make you happy. Hopefully it will make you fulfilled somewhere down the line, because I don't know what makes you happy. Yeah?
Could it also be somewhat of a portrayal of what we see of the poor people?
Sure.
Because if I would know that if I was in a less fortunate country, and other countries were coming over, some people are embarrassed of... they're less fortunate. And I have friends who are less fortunate than me.
Right.
And I've offered them help. I've offered them money. I've offered them medical help and stuff like that. And they have denied it because they are embarrassed of how
sure.
they are, but they act happy even though they are not.
Right. That could be. John.
Well, John, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but to say that in general, richer people are happier than...
I'm not saying that at all. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we can say to some degree that, but that doesn't mean that as we get beyond a certain point, as we get richer and richer, we get happier.
Yeah.
The stats don't bear that out at all.
No, I think that's absolutely right. In fact, it's clear that as you get richer, you get healthier, you live longer. We have societies which, and John said, I think, is perfectly right on about the difference between Europe and the United States. It really bugs me that anybody goes to bed hungry in the United States. You know, that we don't provide for, we don't take care of our own people. I think that sucks. It's my fault. It's your fault. It's our government. It's not somebody else makes it. It's our choices. We're living with our choices. Okay? Now, I don't want to get too far on this happiness thing, because I think this can take us off into realms, and I'm almost running out of my 10 minutes here. Okay. read Machiavelli. You can read The Prince. I know some of you have read The Prince. The best book, Machiavelli's real book of political science is called The Discourses of Livy. Livy was a historian of Rome. He lived about the time of Augustus. Dan's been, I'm sure you've been reading Livy at night, right, to tell these stories?
Every night.
And so Machiavelli talks about Livy. Machiavelli is really one of the first modern political scientists, political theory. And what happens when you read Livy and when you read about Rome is that there's the aristocrats and there's the plebes. Okay. It's not really quite like the plebes or the downtrodden masses, because when you read Livy, you find out, no, the plebes are the really rich guys who are successful, who do not belong to patrician families. And to take the auspices and to perform religious duties in Rome, you have to be from a particular family. Adoption is very important, as we learned this morning, within Rome, because a family will adopt a talented commoner into their family, and then that person becomes part of the family and then can do all the right kind of stuff. So the plebes who are most important are also wealthy. And most of the non-citizens, there's lots of slaves and people like that in Rome. But what happens when you read Livy is that there is chaos all the time when the plebes and the aristocrats are fighting. The plebes have to show up for the army, and the aristocrats are automatically officers. And there are times when the barbarians are at the gates, the enemies are at the gates, and the plebes say, not fighting. Just not fighting. Not going to do it. Okay, and then, Rome gets overrun, and then Cincinnatus has to come in from his farm and rescue him and lead, becomes dictator. There's all kinds of stories there. So that what Machiavelli says is that when you read Roman history, it looks like all the bad times are when the two main parts of society can't get together, and he says, you're missing the point if that's the way you read Roman history. The tug and back and forth between the plebes and the aristocrats, as long as that is in balance, this is a vital society. Now, we talked about the Dan John world as one of balance of economic and political and religious and social interests. That a natural state is stable is better when the pieces of it are in better balance. When the pieces get out of balance, war is likely and violence is likely to happen. And so Machiavelli's political science is a science of balance. Yep.
But doesn't Machiavelli also state that it's better to be hated than loved?
That's in The Prince. That's if you're a dictator. If you happen to be wrong of Dan or John, how should you stay alive? should you be good or should you be bad? Well, you've got to err on the be hated rather than the love side. Love is good, but not everybody's happy. Right? And not everybody will love you. That's The Prince. That's not The Discourses. The Discourses are Machiavelli's blueprint for building a republic, not for building a tyranny. So this idea of balance is one that Machiavelli is developing. His favorite historian is Polybius. Polybius is a Greek who, his father is a political leader in begins with an A, coalition, sort of the northwestern part of Greece. It's not the Aegean League, I can't think of it. What happens when the Romans take him over? They go around, they get all the sons and daughters of the prominent politicians and hostage them. They take them to Rome so that the Greeks will behave. If the Greeks don't behave, they kill their son. It works. Polybius actually ends up getting to stay in the Scipio a family household. Scipio Africanus is the man who burns Carthage. So he's got an inside look at Rome. And Polybius says, how did Rome conquer the world? He said, well, Rome conquered the world because it had balance. It had a constitution, not a written document, but a body politic, in which the interests of the one, the few, and the many are balanced off. You have the councils, you have the big leaders, you have the Senate, which is the aristocracy, and you have the assembly, which represents the plebs. And as long as those three things are in balance, you don't get tyranny. But if any one of them gets overwhelming control, you end up with tyranny. Now, this turns out, those like, you see the idea there? That you got, we have it, in our system, it's called checks and balances. The executive, legislative, judicial branches, and we can play those, we can talk about those things. In fact, this theme dominates Western political philosophy to this day. Okay? This notion of balance. But the notion of balance in that sense is a natural state notion of balance. That we have groups that are set off against one another. It's not surprising that this is what they see, because this is how the world is organized. You know, can we put economic and political interests together in such a way that they balance one another off? So what is corruption in that sense? Well, we know about venality. Because there's always public officials that are willing to do things for their own good rather than public good. And we know people who do not act in a fiduciary responsibility. We know people are only interested in themselves and not in others. And in fact, some are happy and some are unhappy. Right? And so venality, can we get rid of that? No. If we make all people saints? God can, we can't. Right? We need the law to do that. We need the law because not everybody's a saint. So what Machiavelli and Polybius and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton will regard as corruption in the constitution of a society is a loss of balance. Okay? That one group gets the ascendancy. That's really what the American Revolution is all about, is a fear that the king has gotten too much power in Britain and is going to tyrannize the colonies. So they revolt. There's a wonderful book by Bernard Bailyn called The Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, if you're interested in reading about that. And I would have talked about this yesterday, but we didn't have a session, so we're going to skip over that.
John, how much closer is America getting towards that? You know, like the CEOs are making $400.
Yeah, no, I think Halliburton's a problem.
Okay. But will there come a time when the plebs in America start taking hostages from congressmen?
Let's think about that. So that in America, and in fact in Britain, and in fact in Europe at this time, there was a problem. You all know who Adam Smith is? Okay, Adam Smith writes The Wealth of Nations, which is generally regarded as the founding book in economics, and Adam Smith is regarded as the founder of modern economics. Smith is living in what he perceives to be a natural state. And is Smith for or against corporations? He's an economist, right? How many think for? How many think against? How many don't have any idea? And he's against them. Okay? In fact, Smith is saying that natural states are a problem. Smith is inveighing against Dan John's systems in which the government manipulates the economy to provide political stability. And he says, if you want economic growth, if you want to increase the wealth of your nation, you must allow people to compete. So Smith sees a corporate charter as a grant of privilege, as part of a natural state. The United States, when it's formed, takes its institutions from Britain. We see corporations as threats to liberty because, in fact, they are mechanisms by which the polity can create a privileged organization. Okay. Now, I won't not have time to talk about how all this stuff happened. In the very first Congress of the United States, the Congress that met in 1790 and 1791, they had to figure out the problem of repaying the nation's debts. We talked a little bit about that on the ARC yesterday. Cancel all debts was part of Jubilee, right? And in order to do that, they created a bank, the Bank of the United States, which was a big bank, was the biggest bank in the country, wasn't the only bank. And immediately upon the creation of the bank, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison cried, corruption. It turned out that their political opponent was Alexander Hamilton, who was allied with George Washington. And they claimed that Hamilton was going to use the privileges embedded in the charter of the Bank of the United States to form a political faction which would take over the American government and tyrannize us and turn us all into slaves. And Thomas, these guys knew what slavery was about. They owned slaves. Okay? And they said, we're threatened with slavery, not that we're going to be the property of Alexander Hamilton. We're going to lose our freedoms if our government does not stay balanced, and if Hamilton is able to use the Bank of the United States to form a political faction that unbalances the government, tyranny and slavery will follow, because we're going to be back in a Dan John world, which the politicians use economics to keep themselves in power. That's corrupt. Okay? That's our language. We learned at the founding that corporations were evil. Okay? The very first political debates were about those evil corporations. Washington got so pissed at Jefferson and the way he was playing politics with this issue that he would not talk to him for the last 10 years of his life. And Jefferson, praise be his name, as people in Virginia say, was a real politician who could not appear to be a politician, because to be a politician would be to form a faction that was contending for political control. We had to have good government. Government that did not act in any interest, right, but acted for the good of us all. That's part of our political language in the United States, right? Is it part of our political reality in the United States?
Yeah.
Often not, because politics is competitive, right? People want to say, I'm in charge of the good. And we all do that. We compete for different visions of the good. But we have, in fact, competitive political parties. One of the things that happened in the 1840s and 30s was we began to get stable political competition. We began to say, you know, this isn't such a bad deal. Parties are okay. Do we still have trouble with it? Yes. Do we suspect the politicians are out for themselves and not for our good? All the time. Can we get rid of venality? Can we get rid of sin? No. Okay. Now, the word corruption, as it was used by Madison and Hamilton, referred not only to venality, it referred to what I call systematic corruption. It referred to the mechanisms that work in the natural state. If you are lucky, you live in a natural state with stability, which is a natural state that has balance. Okay? In which the powerful interests in society are actually successful at being peaceful. If you live in a bad natural state, you live in one in which the balance is precarious. Most of Africa lives in bad natural states today. Bad in the sense that they are precarious. Yeah?
What's a stable natural state?
Argentina, Brazil, Mexico. I mean, how many political parties won elections in Mexico in the 20th century?
Two.
Yeah, the PRI won for like 75 years. Okay, was it repressive?
No.
Yeah, did it promote equal human rights in Mexico?
No.
Did it play games with water?
Yeah.
Okay, but it was stable, right? What in the how many? Does anybody know how many revolutions there were in the 19th century in Mexico?
A continuous one.
A continuous one. I think there was a period of 56 years in which they had 75 revolutions. The Mexicans were quite happy to get a dictator who would stop the revolutions. Okay? And there are places in the world in which violence continues to happen, imposed by the outside, imposed by the inside. And in fact, the natural state is the natural response to endemic violence. Right? Now, the transition happens when the Dan John world, competition is what?
Allowed.
No.
Allowed?
No. It's not allowed. And why is everybody willing to live without competition? Competition is dangerous. Okay? Because if political competition breaks out, it's going to break out with weapons, probably between Dan and John. Or Debbie. Debbie wants to take over. Debbie's happy to take over. She said that on Monday. She got to be the trade minister for Dan. And she said, I want to get rid of Dan. Right away, she got it. I want to get rid of Dan. Okay, that's why Dan has to remain heavily armed. Competition is dangerous in a natural state. You do not want political competition. In fact, that's why the Founding Fathers said political parties are evil. Read Federalist Paper number 10. It talks about the evils of faction. Now, It's hard to change the experience of people, to have them see that a system with entry and access can in fact work and will not break up into pieces. Now, here we are, finally, for the problems of economic development. And I know I've been talking a lot, but I only got 10 more minutes left. Does anybody want to say anything?
Good question. When you talk about stability, are you talking about perfect stability or sort of wobbly stability?
Wobbly stability.
Because we tend to accept politically that things are going to be wobbly. That there's
right.
going to be
oh, yeah.
pendulum swings of power. And we yeah. don't really look at long-term stability. We're satisfied with
right.
consistent wobble. As
yeah,
long
we
as
are.
The wobble leans our direction.
Are they in China? No, they. If you lived in China today, would you be tolerant of wobbly politics? No, because you'd really be worried that the whole thing would blow up. Right? You know, so we have actually in our society we tolerate a lot more instability. In fact, because we don't worry about the system blowing up. Okay. Whereas if you live in a natural state, you're much less tolerant of instability because you worry about changing balances because you know that it can explode. And when I say stability, I'm talking about human behavior, right? We're talking about human society, so they're never stable for very long. You know, how many cultures have there been in America in the last 100 years? A lot. Yet we can confidently talk about American culture as if it was a thing that would be stable, right? Stability is a problematic word to use, and you're right to say, what do I mean? Okay. Let's think about now we want to promote economic development. Well, here's kind of the way economists think about it. It's a slope. You know, there's some key countries down here and some countries up here, you know, and if we just make these guys a little bit better, you know, they'll get better, they'll get richer. You read all the time, oh, Africa has a setback on its road to development. I don't see Africa developing. Okay? So if you've heard of the Washington Consensus, it's a sort of a plan for economic development that's big in the development community, which is both the IMF and the World Bank and the NGOs that do development. You know, can we gradually make things a little bit better in these countries and hope that they'll grow? And the answer seems to be no. Okay, this line is down here. Yeah, they have batteries. They have bottles. They have penicillin. Right? They have more stable food supplies because they can buy in a bigger market, like we were talking about yesterday. Right? That they have access to ocean-going transport so they can get food in a famine more easily. But are they steadily growing and catching up to these guys? No. In fact, there appear to be islands, not slopes. These are the non-developing countries of the world. Argentina is not catching up to the United States. In fact, in 1900, it got really close. The price of wheat went way up in 1900. Which helped American farmers in the Midwest and people in North Dakota. It helped people in Argentina because they were mostly farmers and cattlemen. Right, so their income got close to the United States, and now the per capita income in Argentina is about $5,000, and America is about $45,000. Okay. So Argentina got it wasn't on this path. It was on this one. Okay, it's this kind of society, a natural state. Or a Dan, Erlander, John society, right?
How is that related to the debt? These countries with their debt to us.
Yeah, that's really complicated. It's not
lending from the former colonial powers that.
Don't worry about it. Okay. In these countries, they tend to borrow money and not pay it back. Okay? Because who borrows money?
The elite.
Yeah. Okay. In these societies, they borrow money and they tend to pay it back. And what do they tend to borrow money for?
Competition.
Okay. Remember, did anybody hear my proclamation? I said the number 285. A really important number. In last fiscal year, the fiscal year that ended in 2005, state and local governments in the United States borrowed $285 billion, and almost all of them went for roads, schools, water, utilities, and infrastructure. Okay? In Brazil, the recent financial crisis in the government was caused because local governments were able to borrow money and dump the liability onto the central government, so the central government ultimately had to go bankrupt. And now Brazil has a law that says local governments, provinces, and cities in Brazil collectively cannot borrow more than $175 million. In total! Not annually, in total. How many roads is Brazil going to build over the next 10 years? Zippo. It's going to be really hard because they can't mobilize the wealth to do that. Is canceling the debts good for these guys? Probably not. Argentina has defaulted on its debt 7 times since 1825 or 26. 7 times. When people loan money to Argentina, what do they want?
High interest rates.
They want to get their money up front. Okay, and you know what happens when they loan money to Argentina? Some people get a mine, some people get a concession, they'll get a trade. They'll, in fact, strengthen the natural state in Argentina because they'll want more security than just the bonds. The problem we have is it's hard for us to see that these economies are different societies.
In 1,000 years, which societies will prevail, though? You know, I'm thinking of the
tsunami. I don't know.
The tsunami thing. You know, all these rich people had cell phones. They could have known there was a wave coming.
Yeah.
And the Aborigines, when the ground shakes, they take their longboat out to the ocean.
No kidding. That's good. That's great. I think that's marvelous.
The higher the goal, the longer the fall is. I'm thinking, who
are you buying into?
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, if you're up at Holden, you don't have a whole lot. If the economy tanked...
Oh, come on.
If
you're at Holden, you don't have a whole lot. What a crock of crap. Are we sitting in the woods?
Fly over here.
Anything to say that we are poor at Holden, because we are rich at Holden. We are rich in things and we are rich in spirit, right? And we have the luxury of debating whether we'd be a little better off if we had a little less meat. I have a conclusive vote on that one. When I was cook, I worked for Paul, and there was more meat!
Things are bad.
The richer you are, the harder the fall.
Right. That's
okay? The poorer you are, the quicker you die. Right, John? What happens? If there was the bird flu, and it spread equally throughout the world, wherever most people die. Third world countries. Because they literally are not healthy enough to withstand it. If there's a flu epidemic in the United States, who will die?
The
young and the old. Because biologically, they are least... They have the fewest biological resources.
In 1990, it was the 20-year-olds that died.
What?
And the babies and the old people survived.
Well, look, if you get a flu that attacks 20-year-olds, they're going to die. Right? Your story. Look, we're talking about recorded human history. There's a lot of stories out there. Right? But there are a lot. I mean, I love John. Because he's got all these facts. You know? He loves numbers. I came out one morning, we're sharing Chalet 11. I've been asking about labor force participation. He's flipping through. Here's the labor force. He came up and look. And he had circled the labor force participation numbers of these European countries. When you look at the numbers, the stories, you know, the stories are important and they're there. Boy, but the averages, you know, the outcomes are here. You know, and these are real. These aren't fake. They're not an accounting trick. Go to India. Go to the Delhi airport and try to get a drink of water. There's one drinking fountain in the Delhi airport, as far as I can tell. And it's a hose spigot in a wall in an alcove. And nobody is going there. Okay? A bottled water is a deal in Delhi. Especially, and the Indians are going, they're getting bottled water in the airport.
But then, isn't the economy flourishing when we hear about India?
Yes, it is! Because they're so poor! If your per capita income is $800 per year and you grow by one PlayStation per person, your per capita income rate goes up by 50%. Right? So when we say their economy is flourishing, we're saying they're growing at a more rapid rate. Would you rather get an 8% raise when you make $1,000 a year or a 1% raise when you get $8,000 a year? Well, they're the same number. Right? And in fact, you'd rather get the 1% raise and have a higher income than a higher growth rate on a lower one. Is China going to outgrow us? Per capita income in China is $1,700 per year. It's $44,000 in the United States. Are they about to overtake us? No, they're growing at 8% per year because they were so screwed up before.
What about when they call in all the debt they're holding?
Who cares?
Still?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I wouldn't worry about it. That's macroeconomics. We don't really want to go there. I can tell those stories and do that. We don't. Look, this is. We want to do our neighbor good, not ourselves. We need to understand better this process, because believe me, we don't understand what produces modern economic growth. We could have a parade of Nobel Prize winners come through here. And they, you know, Ed Prescott, one of John's favorites. Who's a, I don't know, we wouldn't want to listen to him. We have my co-author on this project who won the Nobel Prize. And they'd say, we don't know how to do it. You know, I'm not sure that I'm right about this. I think, remember on Monday I told you I do research, not. So this is an answer. We need to know. We Christians need to think.
Part of your original premise was that we have trouble understanding other ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Because we sort of live in our
yes.
paradigm.
Yeah.
And we have trouble jumping off our island onto the other island, leaving all of those filters of perception behind us,
yeah.
accurately perceiving the way it is. And your term development really sort of embodies that, because development means sort of a scripted growth toward a
end. Right.
And
that's why we
kind of presume that there is a place that teleologically
we're going
to.
Right, that's
and,
right.
And I think that your initial premise sort of captures that whole thing, that if we go to that other place where people seem happier than we seem and the poor, we see it through the filters of our own experience and our own
right.
sort of definitions of what it's like, and we can't let go of,
right.
yeah, you know, if I live in downtown Portland,
yeah.
then I go to downtown somewhere else.
Yeah.
People seem to experience things differently than I do, but we never let go of downtown Portland's framework
values.
Or frameworks.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And that's
framework.
Maybe
that's part of
why we struggle so much with this
yeah.
getting how economies develop, because we can never really get out of the 200-year span that we're in and the time
right.
and place.
And that's Jay. I mean, the answer to Jay's question is we need another 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we're running the experiment right now.
Have you read the book, The World is Flat, and how it's going faster and faster?
Mm-hmm.
That,
well, I have. I've
India,
seen it, though. I've looked at it.
The India thing.
John?
We should caution, though, that there isn't this sort of perfect connection between GDP levels or growth. And because, a state in India, Kerala, which has a GDP slightly lower than India as a whole, has much better numbers in terms of health,
right.
in terms
yeah.
of longevity,
yeah.
in terms of all those kind of things, because they do things differently.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. And there's different kinds of, in fact, a friend of mine came up with a concept of the physical quality of life, which was an index which measured infant mortality, life expectancy, that sort of thing. This, which used to be one of the best countries in the world, Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka, I think Kerala is close to Sri Lanka in India, right?
Kerala is on the southwest
yeah.
side, and Sri Lanka is
on
the
southeast side. It was apparent. And what's happened in Sri Lanka?
Civil war.
No, in fact, order has broken down in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And the health outcomes are deteriorating rapidly because of it. Now, I asked this question, was wealth demoralizing? I didn't answer it last Friday. And I'm past time today, but I want to take a crack at it.
this differences have to do with our morals?
We all won the birth lottery. We got born here. We might have gotten smarter, dumber parents, or richer or poorer parents, or whatever. I think there's real questions about the theology of our wealth and how we live our lives. People who win lotteries often are very unhappy, right? When their life changes by being given more wealth. These outcomes and the biggest differences in wealth across the world are products not of individual decisions, but of the way societies interact. Mm-hmm. Right? We're privileged to live in a society in which we enjoy a tremendous amount of personal freedom, and we have trouble figuring out, is that a cause or an effect? And of course, it's both. Okay. I don't know the answer about if I get more wealth or if I consume more, or will I be happier if I consume less, or those are questions that we have to answer as individuals embedded in the societies that we're embedded in. Right? Is this wealth demoralizing? I don't think so. I don't think it's the result of immoral acts. I think it's the result of figuring out a way to have a society that's richer, that has more organizations, that has some evil corporations, but nonetheless has competition between powerful individuals and between weak individuals. Almost everything John has talked about in terms of changing the world is possible because we live in a competitive society where we can make choices, and those choices will have impacts. So, no, I don't think that kind of wealth is demoralizing. In fact, it's the product, of a social system rather than of individual decisions. For both last week and this week, I want to say thank you to all of you. I had a great time. I haven't been to Holden in 28 years. I've had a tremendous homecoming, and I've learned a lot from talking with people and for having the opportunity to try to explain to you some of my ideas. So thank you very much.